Greetings and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm your host, Monica Black. As you know, at New Books in History, we scour the globe for exciting new history books the world needs to know about, and we interview their authors. And today I have the distinct pleasure of speaking with Tori Olson, who is Assistant Professor of History at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. Professor Olson has just published Agrarian Crossings, Reformers, and the Remaking of the U.S. and Mexican Countryside with Princeton University Press, in their America in the World series, and a lot of terrific books, really terrific books have come out of that series, of course. Professor Olson's book tells a remarkable and fascinating and underappreciated story. It's about how in the 1930s and 40s, a group of reformers in the United States and in Mexico undertook to transform the rural worlds of their respective countries in the name of social justice and agrarian productivity. In this fine-grained analysis, which Professor Olson calls not a comparative history, but a history of comparisons, he demonstrates how closely the histories of Mexico and the American South paralleled one another. Parallel histories yielded parallel problems, chiefly mass rural poverty and economic deprivation. And he says, whether in Mississippi or Michoacan, Tennessee or Tabasco, the rural masses saw few tangible benefits in the economic miracle heralded by boosters in Atlanta and Mexico City. And so in that decade, historians sometimes like to call the long 1930s, Mexican and U.S. reformers crossed the border again and again to share models and ideas and to undertake a project of rural revitalization with varying methods and varying results. And we're going to talk to Professor Olson about all of that now. Professor Olson, how are you today?
I'm doing fantastic. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me, Monica. It's such an honor and pleasure to be on the New Books Network blog. It's great to be here.
Good. I'm so happy to hear that. That's wonderful. Soon the world will be hearing you talk about your book. And we'd like to start, I usually try to start this way, by asking you a little bit about your own kind of path towards the writing of this book, your own intellectual path, and whatever ideas sort of led you to the place where you began with the writing of the book. Can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think most historians often find that their research is intertwined with their own life histories. And I think that I'm no exception, but there's no sort of linear path between who I am and who I am intellectually and between this book. So it deserves a little bit of explanation. I think it's important to understand, in trying to figure out me as an author, is that I kind of started, there's a lot you can learn about me by realizing that I'm a non-American writing American history. So I was, as some listeners might guess by my name, I'm Scandinavian originally. I was born and raised in Sweden to Swedish parents, and came to the United States when I was about 10 years old. And got really, really fascinated with American history from pretty early on, from a pretty young age. But I came at American history from a different angle of those who'd been born and bred within the United States, who kind of grew up imbibing the sorts of national myths that are a big part of American history. So I think I've been sort of allergic to American exceptionalism from the very beginning, from about age 10 or so, whether I didn't use those words back then, of course. But I've come at American history from a different perspective. Now, why the heck does that bring the American South and Mexico into the equation? That deserves a little more explanation as well, right? So I went off to university in the U.S. I went to the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. And while there, I immediately gravitated toward history, which had always been my favorite field. And something about American history in particular really appealed to me. It just seemed so exotic to me, right? I think a lot of undergrads in the U.S. see American history as something familiar and boring. But to me, as a Swede coming from outside, American history seemed so exotic and seemed so just crazy and different from Swedish history, for example, right? And I think the one black hole that really sucked me in when I was an undergraduate was the Civil War. Just this massive bloodshed over the question of slavery, it just seemed, again, so foreign and different to Swedish history or Scandinavian history in many ways. So I got pulled into that, and if I'd thought the United States was a weird place, learning about the American South, it seemed like an even weirder place to begin with. So I was so captivated by history as an undergraduate that when I finished, I knew I'd be applying for graduate school, and it was U.S. Southern history that really appealed to me more than anything at all. So that took me down to the University of Georgia, where I ended up doing a master's and a PhD, and ended up living 8 years in the state of Georgia. That was my first introduction to Southern living. and being down there again as this Swede, kind of a Swedish Yankee, right? Because I'd been in Massachusetts for most of my life in the U.S. previously. As a Swedish Yankee trying to figure out what made the South tick, both now and in the past, it led me to a bunch of different epiphanies as well, right? I think I became frustrated with the way that a lot of Americans approached Southern history, in the sense that I got the sense that so much of Southern history had been written as a counterfactual. Basically, why the South didn't become more like the North, right? Like why Mississippi didn't become more like Minnesota. I feel like so much Southern history has been written from that lens. And then I also got this real sense that a lot of Southern history had been written from the perspective of isolation and disconnection as representing the major defining characteristics of the South, right? That what made it unique was that it was disconnected from national trends, that it was disconnected from global and international trends as well. So this is a sort of stew that I was percolating in as I got toward this project in particular. And if you'd like, I'd be happy to say more about, you know, the book itself and how I came to it. This is the kind of general milieu that I was living and breathing in, working my way up to it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Let's do that next, because that was going to be sort of my follow-up question, was to ask you to sort of, at least here at first, let's just sort of walk through what you think the kind of key themes of the book are. We'll flesh these themes out later as we go along, but if you want to kind of give the readers a kind of a chunk of what you know, the important parts of the book for you.
Sure. Well, let me start off. I think a lot of the story of how I came to this research project, it grew out of two sort of aha moments. And a lot of it came when I was reading for my comprehensive exams, funnily. This is something important for graduate students listening to this and terrified of the prospect of doing exams and, you know, thinking of it as a, you know, torture chamber of sorts. Well, it might be, but you have some really good ideas while you're doing it because you're just digesting so much information at the time. And while I was reading for my exams, I came across two sort of aha moments, like, why has no one talked about this? And the first one was basically this, that during the 1930s in the United States and in Mexico, you've got these left-leaning populist presidents, Franklin Roosevelt and Lázaro Cárdenas in Mexico, who are expanding the size of their governments and their government's reach into everyday people's lives, and are talking openly about social justice, right? About inequality and about how to do something about it. And they're talking particularly about rural inequality, right? I mean, the United States and Mexico, the U.S. was largely a rural nation, even more so in Mexico. So in this shared moment, you have these two presidents overseeing these large rural reform movements, and no one had ever written about them together. No one had ever talked about Cárdenas and Roosevelt together. I mean, there'd been small things in articles here and there, but there'd never been a comparative study. There'd never really been anything. And this struck me as something that seemed so impossibly obvious that it had to be taken on, right? It seemed to me like a real piece of low-hanging fruit in many ways. That a transnational historian, someone who's trained in multiple languages and in multiple historiographies, could just snap up and munch on pretty really quickly and easily, right? Low-hanging fruit that you've got this moment, you know, from the very top level of presidential history, you've got these two reformers, these reformist presidents, doing somewhat similar things. So were they similar? Were they different? And my main question that I came at was, were they influenced by one another, right? Was Roosevelt paying attention to Cárdenas and vice versa? Was there any overlap? Was there any dialogue? Was there any conversation? And my book, we'll talk more about it later on, but I found that absolutely there was plenty of that. Okay, so that's the first kind of aha moment. Like Roosevelt and Cárdenas, 1930s, U.S. and Mexico, two countries right next door to one another. Why has no one ever written about them as a common moment, as being part of a common sort of effort? The second sort of epiphany that I had, also while reading comps, I think this is actually during my oral exam, which is hilarious, that, you know, 3 hours of tooth-pulling agony actually yielded one of the best insights that I ever had in my intellectual career so far, which was about a phenomenon known as the Green Revolution, okay? And the Green Revolution, I bet there's still some listeners who probably never even heard of this, right? And don't feel bad about that, listeners. That's not a problem. A lot of people still don't really know or haven't heard that much about the Green Revolution. It's one of my favorite things to talk about and to write about and think about, because I really think it's one of the most important things that's happened in the course of the 20th century. It really gets not enough credit for its importance. So in a nutshell, the Green Revolution is understood broadly as the extension of U.S. agricultural technologies and methods to the so-called Third World during the Cold War, right? During the 1950s, 60s, and 70s in particular. Technologies and techniques such as hybrid seeds, chemical pesticides, synthetic fertilizers, mechanical irrigation techniques, mechanization via tractors and some things like that, extended from the United States into India, into Mexico, into Colombia, Afghanistan, the Philippines. This massive campaign that was undertaken for multiple decades by U.S. reformers and their allies in other countries to try to, what they saw as feeding the world, right? Trying to produce more food and thus end hunger and, better yet, end communism, because everyone knows that if you have a full belly, you don't vote for the communists or you don't start a revolution, right? So the Green Revolution has been largely understood as this major event in global history, right? And I think there's been a bunch of great books that have come out in the last decade that have made the Green Revolution much more of a sort of everyday word in 20th century global history. But the Green Revolution in the existing literature, at least when I was taking my comprehensive exams, when I came up with this aha moment in 2010, was that this was a story of the Third World, right? This was a story of the global South. This was not part of American history, right? This is not part of First World history. This is a part of global South history. It's how India came to transform its wheat production, or Mexico to transform its corn production, and how this was an incredibly important transitional point in feeding people and making possible our massive global populations today, but then also in changing the countryside and uprooting peasants who couldn't adopt some of these new technologies, in causing widespread inequality, landlessness, all these sorts of issues. But it was taught and written about largely as something that happened, you know, in the southern tier of the world, right? So I was reading in a sort of global history list for my exams, and this is the literature I'm coming across. But then I'm also reading in my southern history, U.S. southern history list, that talks all about the Rockefeller Foundation. And the Rockefeller Foundation is largely understood as the pioneer of the Green Revolution. They were a New York-based philanthropy who undertook many of these agricultural extension techniques in Mexico, India, Philippines, places like this. They're often written about as the key protagonists in this sort of traditional global Green Revolution narrative. But as I was reading through my American South list at the very same time, I was figuring out that there's lots and lots of literature, lots and lots of historiography that deals with Rockefeller reformers, not in India or the Philippines, but in Georgia and in Mississippi and Alabama. Because the Rockefeller philanthropy, as it began, was not in the 1950s and 60s in the Cold War context, but it was in the first decade of the 20th century. It was in 1903, 1904, when the Rockefeller family begins giving money to organized philanthropy. And their primary target is the American South, because the American South was this sort of domestic laboratory in many ways for conceiving of poverty and underdevelopment. And so I was reading in these American, in this U.S. South literature about Rockefeller reformers in the progressive era, in the, you know, roughly between 1906 and 1914. And then I was reading about the Green Revolution in Mexico and India in the 1940s and 50s and 60s, but there was absolutely no link, right? The folks working on Southern history had no clue about the Green Revolution, or if they had a clue, they didn't mention it, right, as something that was connected to what the Rockefeller reformers did in the South beforehand. And then the global Green Revolution literature on the so-called Global South never mentions the American South, right, or very, very rarely in passing, right? There's very little mention of the fact that these global campaigns that were so transformative during the Cold War got their start within the American South, right? So this seemed to me like a really important moment as well, that I could thread this acknowledged theme in U.S. Southern history with this major theme in sort of global South history, And I could get at that sort of irony, right, of American South and global South. I mean, the American South, for much of its history, has also been a sort of periphery within the core of the United States. And it's a place that's had a history that looks a lot like India, Mexico, Cuba, Brazil. I mean, the list goes on and on. And this is, it's not new to think this way. It's probably the most important Southern historian of the 20th century was this guy C. Van Woodward, who's at Yale for many, many decades. And he, in the 50s, he wrote this fantastic piece about the irony of Southern history. And the irony of Southern history, he wrote in the 50s, was that a lot of folks are shocked at, you know, coming from a Northern vantage point, are shocked at why the South looks so different from the North, like right, that it faced poverty and military defeat and underdevelopment. But the irony is that the South just looks a lot like the rest of the world in many ways, and that the North is the exceptional part. The North underwent a historical path of development that didn't look anything like most of the world's population, right? So Woodward is talking about this back in the 50s. It just had been really slow in coming out in the historiography, and I thought that with this Green Revolution story, I could leap into it and try to get myself heard in that debate.
Yeah.
So those are the two sorts of aha moments, right? The 30s and the South and Mexico. The Roosevelt and Cardenas together at the moment, and then this Green Revolution story that spans throughout the 20th century. Those are the two moments that really drive the book and the two sort of major arguments that I'm trying to make.
Yeah, you know, that's a great story. I like that story a lot too, because it is so true in our lives as historians that it's very often that the best questions come to us when we're looking at disparate things, at things that are not supposed to belong together, we think, and then we start reading a bit more and we find out that actually these two things, it's crazy to us that they haven't been discussed together in the same frame before. So that's a fantastic story. And I hope lots of graduate students are listening too. Because but for all of us really, I mean, that's how you come to a project, is you have a moment where suddenly something that, you know, one of these things is not like the others. And then in fact, it is, you know, and what a great revelation that is. So let me ask you to continue.
Right. I mean, just to be reading American and Latin American history at the same time, in the same week with the same books, that for me gave rise to so many fruitful questions and problems. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And then, sorry, go ahead, please.
It almost seems like fate then, you know, that you happen to be reading them together.
Yeah.
Right. I'm just going to ask you now to get a little bit deeper into the book and the kind of the way that the book is structured. And one of the chapters that I liked the best was, I think it's chapter one, where you very beautifully lay out the kind of political, agricultural, social, structural similarities between Mexico and the United States South. And you kind of demonstrate the parallel histories of these two places from the 1870s through the 1920s. So I wonder if you could kind of talk to us about those parallels and about the project to thrust the U.S. South and Mexico more fully into capitalist modernity, as you put it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to talk about it. Yeah, so chapter one is titled Parallel Agrarian Societies. And it basically serves as a sort of a stage setter, right, to invite readers into the narrative, into the action that comes later, by looking at the American South and Mexico, not quite all of Mexico, but the plantation regions of Mexico in particular, which are wide and cover good chunks of the country. And basically looking at whether these places are maybe more similar than they are different during the lead up to the story. So from, like you said, the 1870s through the 1920s. The basic story that I tell in narrating these places side by side, and I will say that this chapter is somewhat of unique within the book, because it actually is a comparative history above all, right? The five chapters that follow are really connective histories, or as I call them, histories of comparison, of historical actors themselves making comparison. And in this chapter where I look at the South and plantation Mexico over this 50-year time span, it's really comparative, right? I'm basically laying out the development of these two places side by side, not to show necessarily influence and connection between them, but to invite readers in to learn about what was going on, right? And a lot of the reason I wrote this chapter too, which felt odd in some times, but I'm really excited to hear that you liked it, was knowing that my audience might be from either historiography, right? That I might have Mexican historians reading this book, and then I'd likely have plenty of U.S. historians reading it too, and I kind of assumed that neither really knew much about the other side, right? I mean, most people who work on the U.S. South, or really U.S. history as a whole, are not deeply versed in Mexican history. And likewise for historians of Mexico as well. They might know the broad contours, especially if they are Americans or if they work within the United States. They might know the broad contours of American history, but they probably weren't super familiar with the populist movement and what it might mean in the 1880s and 1890s, right? So basically, in this 1870s to 1920s period, I argued that there's a heck of a lot of parallels and similarities between what happens in the United States South and in Mexico. Right? To start off with, both places are invaded militarily. The United States invades Mexico in the 1840s, and then the U.S. South is invaded by the U.S. government, by the North, right, in the 1860s. And those invasions do massive damage to their societies, and there's this long period of trying to figure out what comes afterward, right, during Reconstruction in the United States and then these liberal wars of reform in Mexico that follow in the 1850s, 1860s, to figure out what's going on, right? And then, of course, the French are involved in Mexico, too, and invade in the 1860s, so quite at the same time period when the U.S. South is being invaded by the U.S. North. But in the aftermath of these invasions, you have the rise of this new political elite. In Mexico, this is most commonly known as the Porfiriato, the period of the reign of Porfirio Díaz, who's in power from 1876, roughly to 1911. And in the United States South, this is a period of New South democratic rule. You have the rise of this political elite that also takes lead after the end of Reconstruction, that basically calls the shots in across the South for even longer than the 19-teens, up through the 1930s, you could argue. So basically look at the Porfirian era and Porfirio Díaz's approach to rural development and capitalist development, and to that of the New South Democrats within the American South. And my basic conclusion, and it's a sort of blunt argument, there's plenty of space for fine-tuning and particularities within the book as well, but that Díaz and the New South Democrats basically had the same idea, right? They wanted to pull this messy, chaotic countryside into the folds of the global economy. They wanted to produce more commodity and cash crops. They wanted to load them onto rail cars, and they wanted to export them around the world and make lots of money for landholders, people who were coming into the ownership of lots of land that had either been held cooperatively or had been a part of the yeoman agriculture within the U.S. South. So in this period, there's this massive consolidation of landholding in both the U.S. South and Mexico. You have yeomen and peasants and smallholders being tossed off the land, very dramatically so in Mexico, but then quite also dramatically in the United States South. And this consolidation of landholding and capitalist agriculture in both these regions makes a lot of folks really, really rich, makes a lot of sort of robber barons in the countryside. But it also is going to lead to two massive social revolts because of the grudges that were built up over the decades as small farmers were dispossessed of their land. And in Mexico, this is the kind of defining moment in modern Mexican history, the Mexican Revolution, right, which defines much of the 19-teens. In the U.S. South, this is going to be the populist movement, which comes earlier during the 1880s and 1890s as well. And am I arguing that the Mexican Revolution and the populist movement in the U.S. South are exactly the same thing? No, of course not. I mean, they end up in very different ways. The Mexican Revolution is way bloodier, much more tumultuous in upsetting society, claiming nearly a million lives. That wasn't true of the populist movement, but they were both movements of dispossessed country people trying to change the system and for them to get a better shake, essentially, to try to regain some of the land and privileges lost in the previous decades. And so I narrate these side by side. It's sort of a historiographical comparative chapter in many ways, right? Looking at the ways historians have treated it, but then also looking at, you know, how our dispossession of smallholders and the rise of tenancy and large plantations in Georgia and Morelos in Mexico. What are the parallels between those? And the basic argument that I make, of course, is that, you know, there's a lot of similarities between them. They're not exactly the same, but I'd say that what the similarities between Georgia and Morelos are greater than that between Georgia and Iowa, yeah. Right? Which I think is an important thing to take away. So it's a sort of the first chapter looks at this broad swath of 50 years, try to bring readers in, right, to bring, get the Americanists up to speed about what the heck was the Mexican Revolution, you know, tell the Mexicanists a little bit about the populist revolt and who the major figure is and what the kind of backstory is that takes us up to the real moment that the book is about, which begins in the early 30s when Cárdenas and Roosevelt gain power in each country.
Yeah, let's talk about the 30s next, because, you know, I love this. There's a great moment early on in your book, and then it comes back again later when Americans go to Mexico in the 30s and they're blown away by the possibilities of a real revolution, which included expropriating and deeding hundreds of thousands of acres of prime land to landless peasants. And both regions, as you described, shared the problem of landlessness. And I love this. You have this great, there's a great little, you know, but there's a really nice moment in your book when you say at one point that Mexico was very much in vogue in the 1930s in art and culture, of course, but it was also in vogue in land reform.
Right. Yeah, I think Americans responded to the Mexican Revolution in lots of different ways, right? I mean, I think most political leaders after 1911, after the violence breaks out in Mexico, most political leaders in the U.S. saw it as creeping socialism that they saw as a threat that, you know, a Bolshevik revolution, especially after 1917, that this was a communist revolution that was a threat to the stability of the United States, right? So a lot of conservatives in the U.S. are seeing it as a dangerous red terror south of the border. But then there's a lot of other Americans, particularly, you know, on the left, progressive reformist folks who had seen the progressive movement sort of squashed within the United States after the end of World War One, who really looked quite romantically to Mexico as a place where, you know, their wildest dreams are finally being realized. So you have this steady stream, especially during the 20s and peaking in the 30s as well, of American journalists and writers who go down and spend time in Mexico, who hang out with Diego Rivera, right, and who see these romantic portrayals of social revolution and are dreaming of it as something that just can't happen in the United States. You know, the U.S. is, the resistance is too great, but in Mexico, it's happening. And in the 30s, I think the story that most historians know is the sort of cultural exchanges, right? Diego Rivera traveling up to New York to paint in the Rockefeller building there. And these sorts of exchanges of artists and writers and all that sort of thing. I think that's the established narrative of South-North influence, right, of Mexico making a dent onto the United States in this era. But what I dug up in the course of my research was that it wasn't just painters and muralists and artists who were coming from Mexico, but it was political ideas too, right, particularly about how to divide up land and then make that land productive afterward, right? So I look at this through New Deal reformers, particularly those in government. I also look at those outside of government. I look at New Deal reformers who were incredibly, had a very rosy and romantic understanding of Mexico, sometimes very unrealistic too, but that didn't stop them from chasing these dreams down. Folks in the U.S. Department of Agriculture within Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. And the USDA in the 1930s was really one of the most sort of reformist and socially reformist bureaus of the entire New Deal. At least there was a large wing of folks who were very interested in poverty and in getting rid of the plantation complex, especially in the American South, and figuring out how to do this. And they were looking everywhere around the world for ideas, but Mexico is one place where they particularly found plenty of them. So in the book, I look at one particular USDA, one particular New Deal agency that really had its birth in this influence from Mexico. And that's the Farm Security Administration, the FSA. The Farm Security Administration has its sort of a moment in the sun from 1937 to 1943 or so relatively late within the New Deal. But I argue in the book that it's ideas from Mexico and inspiration from Mexico that provides the seed for this agency in the very beginning. And then throughout its operation, reformers within the FSA would take frequent trips down to Mexico to see what they were doing, what was being accomplished there, what they could learn from both the successes and the failures of reformers under Cárdenas, who are involved in one of the largest land reform programs in the history of the Western Hemisphere at the time. And the Farm Security Administration was one of these prime examples, but then there were plenty of others as well, just from outside of the walls of government as well. The Southern Tenant Farmers Union is someone thing quite familiar to most Southern historians as this sort of would-be radical agents, would-be radical union, this biracial cotton pickers union that gets established in 1934 in Arkansas and challenges planter power in a really unprecedented way during the decade. A lot of Southern, this is sort of a standard part of the narrative of the New Deal in the U.S. South. But this is another moment when I was exploring the STFU's, the Southern Tenant Farmer Union's records. This is another example of this low-hanging fruit that, that I found earlier on, right? That there's this long report within the STFU papers on Mexico, that, that the key leaders within the STFU, particularly H.L. Mitchell, who was the main leader of the union, had gone down to Mexico and organized workshops down there in the late 1930s to try to gain ideas for how they could also learn from Mexico. It wasn't just a New Deal, but it was the folks, these sorts of civil society unions that were also drawing influence from Mexico as well. And that was a pretty fascinating thing to find on in the dusty microfilm of the Southern Tenant Farmers Union papers that had been undoubtedly picked over by hundreds of graduate students looking for theses in the last 30 years, but none of them knew anything about Mexico and none of them could speak Spanish. And because of that, they just hopped over this massive report that, you know, was a pretty pretty serious significance to what this union was doing. So in terms of South-North influences, there's lots and lots going on within throughout the 1930s and into the early 1940s as well. And tracking down some of these threads was really, really exciting stuff. It was just so much fun, both in U.S. and Mexican archives, to go looking for the evidence for this because it was just surprisingly abundant.
So interesting, yeah. So let's continue with that thread because I sort of, you know, there were moments in your book when I think that I was thinking when I was reading this book is a history of strange bedfellows, strange connections and unexpected conjunctures. And one of the strange connections or the strangest bedfellows, I think, of your book, and I think you'll probably agree with me, is what is, a white supremacist imperialist Southerner like Josephus Daniels of North Carolina doing championing the New Deal in Mexico?
Yeah. Josephus Daniels. Josephus Daniels is one of the protagonists of the book. And he's just such a weird character that I've spent so many hours trying to figure out what made him tick. And I'm still not entirely sure that I have. He's this kind of classic Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde character in many ways. And it's so fascinating when I started learning about him, about the different ways that U.S. and Mexican historians understood this guy. Okay, so Josephus Daniels is North Carolina reformer, one of the most rabid white supremacists in his state, was involved in the Wilmington race riot in the late 1890s. And this guy's got blood on his hands. He's one of the worst sort of Jim Crow defenders out there. But in U.S. historiography, Daniels is portrayed as exactly that, right? The sort of race-baiting demon of the Jim Crow era who has, you know, not a single redeeming quality. Glenda Gilmore's book, Gender and Jim Crow, I think hammers this home the best. You know, Daniels emerges as a sort of anti-hero, rightfully, within that book. But then, when you're reading Mexican historiography, Daniels is the great gringo who understood Mexico. Daniels is the ambassador to Mexico during the 1930s, from 33 to 42, if I remember correctly. And Daniels is like, comes off as the complete opposite, right? It's like they'd never... The Mexicanist hadn't really grappled with his career in the United States, and the U.S. historians hadn't really grappled with what he did in Mexico. But Daniels is portrayed in Mexican historiography as, the sympathetic gringo who comes down and, you know, realizes that what Cárdenas is doing in terms of land redistribution is required for social stability in Mexico, and he basically lets it go on. He doesn't try to stop it. He doesn't bring the Marines in to try to can this entire experiment. So he comes off very, very romantically in many ways. I mean, I've read some pretty, Daniels gets extolled quite a bit in the Mexican story, the Mexican historiography side of it. And trying to figure out, you know, how he becomes this figure who does indeed come to champion a lot of Cardenas's reforms while he's ambassador, even though Cardenas's reforms were challenging, was taking away land from Americans. I mean, Daniels' job in Mexico as ambassador was to protect the interests of Americans in part, and he's choosing to go with political positions by supporting Cárdenas that were antithetical to that, right? So in doing his job, he's not doing his job in certain senses. But his political sympathies with the revolution and with Cardenismo and the land experiment in the 1930s are so strong that they overrule his, you know, his sort of job description to protect American property, which I find to be quite interesting. And people have written about this sort of riddle a little bit, but I think the real key to understanding what made Daniel so sympathetic to the land reform project in Mexico was that he was really familiar with uneven land tenure in the American South, right? That he'd grown up in North Carolina and seen the rise of plantation agriculture and the rise of tenancy in particular, and saw it as something poisonous and toxic that was sapping his home state. And then he saw Mexico trying to undo that tangled dilemma within Mexico. And then he saw that, you know, this is what needs to be done in Mexico, and heck, this is what needs to be done in the American South as well. And so it's really these sorts of regional particularities that he brings to the table that makes sense out of what his career in Mexico in the 1930s.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's a riddle. He's a weird one.
Absolutely. You know, that was my experience. I'm, as you know very well, I'm not an American historian, and my knowledge of Daniels was precisely that, having to do with the Wilmington race riots. And so I was, right. I found that just very, very fascinating. Let's talk now about another kind of regional transplant, if you will, if that's the right way of saying it. I mean, I was just fascinated by your discussion of the Tennessee Valley Authority and the transplantation, if that's the right way to put it, of what you call, yeah, El Tennessee, or the TVA idea in Mexico. Tell us about how that happened.
Right, right. Yeah. So this is the last chapter of the book, Transplanting El Tennessee, which discusses exactly that, right? The career of the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority, in Mexico, particularly after World War II. And this is actually the last chapter of the book that I wrote. And curiously, it's one that I wrote after arriving to Knoxville and after starting this job at the University of Tennessee, which Knoxville is still the headquarters of the Tennessee Valley Authority. This had only been a real tiny chunk, maybe a sentence or two of the dissertation that I ended up developing much further. I mean, part of it was living here and having more access to TVA records, but then realizing this is a big part of the story of these dialogues between the U.S. South and Mexico, right? Because if the TVA was anything, it was a Southern project. I mean, it was a federal project to try to overcome Southern rural poverty. And it is a story that would have almost as much impact on Mexico as the Green Revolution narrative that I discussed earlier as well. And the Green Revolution has been understood, you know, as a major turning point in the history of rural Mexico. And the Green Revolution, the TVA hydraulic development projects haven't been treated as seriously in Mexican historiography. There's been far fewer books that discuss these hydraulic development bureaus that are founded in the late 40s and during the 1950s, but they're really, really significant and really transform millions of people's lives as well. So in the late 1940s, the basic story is that with the inauguration of Miguel Alemán in 1946, who's often seen as the sort of the rising conservative tide in the institutionalization of the Mexican Revolution, not long after he is inaugurated in late 1946, he unveils these massive plans for building hydroelectric dams and associated road building, public health projects, communications networks, industrializations, and so forth on major rivers within, particularly Mexico's coastal south, within states like Veracruz, Oaxaca, and Chiapas as well. And Alemán undertakes these major projects that are basically sold as, you know, the height of nationalist development, of this institutionalized revolutionary state that was going to use its power to improve people's lives for the better. And in looking for where he's getting these ideas, not just Alemán himself, but these bureaucrats working underneath him, these engineers, it was dramatically clear to me in looking through the press accounts of this that the Tennessee Valley was one of the primary places that Alemán was looking. In fact, when Alemán takes his first trip to the United States in 1946, which is really the first kind of major visit of a Mexican president to the United States since the revolution broke out, so more than 30 years, the places that Alemán stops are Washington and New York, right? Very expected places to go, but then also Chattanooga, Tennessee, and Muscle Shoals, Alabama. And those are not usually the first stops on foreign visits of the United States because, they're pretty small places, but they're incredibly influential because they're both the sites of major TVA dams, right? Wilson Dam and Muscle Shoals and a number of dams around in the Chattanooga area. So Alemán flies in, makes these bold and blowsy comparisons between the Tennessee Valley and the underdeveloped regions of southern Mexico, and then uses these this rhetoric as fuel for publicizing these big dam campaigns that he then launches in Mexico. So I look at a couple key moments, right, like within this narrative, the beginning and unveiling of these projects, but then also the continuous linkages between the Mexican state and the TVA as they undertook these large-scale dam building projects within Mexico. And there's a steady exchange of engineers, of social scientists, drawing comparisons, again, between a place like Veracruz and a place like northern Alabama, which, again, so much of this book is a history of comparisons, and it intrigued me endlessly to read about these public comparisons in the front pages of the Mexican press between these rural areas in the American South and areas that within the southern coast of Mexico that these state builders saw as parallel to them. So it was certainly a really fun part of the story to tell, especially one to tell while living in Knoxville, because I got to give a number of talks to local folks here who'd grown up around the TVA and the TVA employees and officials too about the global history of the TVA. And there's been other historians who've written about TVA and the world, right? There's been great books on TVA in China and India and all around, but no one had really written much on Mexico previously. And with the whole U.S. South-Mexico comparisons that've been a key part of the rest of the book, it seemed like this was an absolutely essential part of the story to tell as well.
Yeah, it's wonderful when our professional lives overlap with our intellectual interests in that way. So you move to Knoxville and suddenly you can write a chapter about the TVA, which might have been... may not even have been as obvious to you a thing to do if you had lived somewhere else.
You're right. Yeah, it was a very happy coincidence. That's
definitely
for sure.
I think you've really done a beautiful job of giving listeners a sense of some of the great themes of the book and arguments, and also some of the interesting characters, interesting politicians and reformers, the institutions that they were working in or that they helped develop. I wonder if I could just ask you I always like to ask historians kind of philosophical questions about their books. And I wonder if you would indulge me just for a moment. In some ways, when I was reading your book, I thought, is this book a history of possibilities realized and possibilities not realized? Do you think that's a fair way to think about your book? I mean, did that occur to you when you have, there's so many ambitious plans and beautiful idealistic schemes, and then none of them work out the way that the people who envisioned them intended. And of course, that's the history of humanity in a nutshell. But I was curious what you would say about that.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's a lot of parts of researching and writing and, hopefully reading this book that are very encouraging and that are very inspiring. But then there's also a lot of things that are very depressing in the sense of these grand schemes that went nowhere. I think particularly at this moment in time, considering the relationship between the United States and Mexico in 2017 in the age of Donald Trump, it is inspiring to hear about these solidarities and networks that existed and of Mexican influences transforming U.S. politics in Washington, D.C. That is really, really exciting. And this is a lesson that I think that we need at this moment more than any other, when the relationship between the United States and Mexico was not so as two enemies, but as two friends approaching kindred problems. So I think that's something that, it's very encouraging to read. But most of the dialogues in there and most of the possibilities that came out of those solidarities, as you rightly mentioned, failed, right? Most of the sort of peasant-friendly elements of the Green Revolution that were inspired by similar problems in the United States South while in Mexico didn't play out. They were eroded by other possibilities, by a sort of Cold War emphasis on production, production, production over any sort of economic livelihoods. The TVA idea, the TVA sort of transplanting as well. I mean, whether the TVA even worked, quote unquote, in East Tennessee is still up in the air. I mean, this region still remains one of the poorest in the United States, and it certainly did no real favors to poor rural people in Mexico in the 1950s and 1960s. But the possibilities were there in many ways, just as they were with the Farm Security Administration as well. But they didn't end the way that most of the idealistic reformers who undertook them imagined them to. So philosophically, in terms of, you know, what's to come and how I see this, whether it gives me faith in civilization and humanity, it's a mixed bag, to be sure.
Yeah, I get that, and you know, I like what you said very much. I think in this moment when things have deteriorated in such a such an unfortunate and really in many ways painful way, it's very nice. I agree with you. It's very nice to read your book and to think about moments when solidarity seems so much more more prevalent, and you know, idealism seemed like a possibility rather than something silly.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, Mexico and the United States are two countries that have a heck of a lot in common that look very similar in certain ways that tends to be forgotten in the debates about immigration and poverty and corruption and, you know, the sort of things that the ways that most Americans understand the Mexico today, that doesn't reflect many of the things that I found in my research at all.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Well, Professor Olson, I've enjoyed talking to you so much, and I know we've taken a lot of your time, and we appreciate that. I wonder if you would tell the listeners, because I know people will be very interested to know what you're working on next, and if I'm not mistaken, it's a very interesting project. So would you mind telling us a little bit about
absolutely.
That?
Yeah, absolutely. So after I finished this book, you know, about almost a year ago, I did a lot of head scratching to figure out, you know, who am I as a historian? What really makes me tick? I've done a lot of stuff in a lot of different areas, and this book it moved me in so many directions that I kind of had to choose one going forwards. And I got down and scratched my head a lot, and I realized that what I am as a historian is I study the rural United States and look at its global interconnections and its global its place within the larger world, right? And most people don't think of rural places as global at all. They think of them as, you know, the antithesis to that. So I wanted to continue down this path of looking at the rural U.S. as that globally connected place, and particularly with interest in the South, right? I mean, I very much come out of Southern history in my training and my interests, and of course, I live in the U.S. South now as well. So I got at the idea that the next book, in a nutshell, is going to be a global history of American country music. It's basically going to be examination of how American country singers and country records find their way into really, really unexpected places and scenarios during the 20th century all across the world. And I think, you know, a lot of people raised their eyebrows when I mentioned this as a project. They're like, country music didn't go anywhere. Are you kidding me? You know, like jazz and rock and roll, sure, they found their way to Berlin and Egypt and God knows where else, you know. But country music, that's the anti-cosmopolitan, right? And hey, you listen to a lot of country songs and they're espousing is precisely that message. Well, that's not actually what happened. Country music did travel and traveled all over. It, in fact, served as a sort of vanguard of what, or served as the representation of American culture for millions and millions of people during the Cold War in particular, who listened to American country records and musicians who were sent all over the world. Some of them were these records and musicians. These songs found their way into these unexpected contexts through lots of different networks and channels. And part of it has to do with the U.S. military, the Armed Forces Radio Network, that, of course, sets up military bases across the world in the post-1945 period, and has plenty of country music being played on these networks to please the large white Southern population that made up much of the military in this time. White Southerners are disproportionately represented in the military. It has to do with the U.S. government sending country singers abroad to play in various parts of the world, whether it's in Eastern Europe or Southern Africa, as representations of what the U.S. stands for. It's a story of capitalism, to be sure, about record companies across multiple different nationalities. But it's moving in a whole lot of directions, but I'm really excited about it. And I think it builds on a lot of the strengths of the multi-sided, multi-historiographical research that went into the first book. But it also looks at a sort of broader perspective than just the North America, but looking at precisely really, you know, all around the world, from East Asia to Africa to across Latin America as well, to see how country music traveled and what its travels meant for, you know, the Cold War, globalization, Americanization, and how people understood the United States at this important moment in time.
I think it sounds amazing. And one of the things I think is amazing about it is that country music itself has a strong connection to the local. I mean, it's intensely nostalgic for the local and the rural, even now when country music stars live in Nashville and live in big cities, and even themselves don't come from the rural South the way that they once did. There's this amazing, if you listen to contemporary country music, this amazing connection to and nostalgia for the rural world. And to link that to the global, to me, is a fantastic move. If you can do it, it's going to be beautiful.
Yeah. Well, I think this is, you know, I think this is part of it. Country music is nostalgic music of a lost countryside. I mean, country music is born out of urbanization within the United States, that it's really meant for city people to, you know, reflect on this lost countryside. Well, the global narrative of population movements in the late 20th century is exactly that. It's of rural people leaving the countryside and going to cities. So I think there's got to be some sort of connection between what this sort of cultural matrix within the United States that made this possible, that also would connect with someone in Zimbabwe or Colombia or Mexico, that, you know, if you're a rural person who's trying to deal with city life and romanticizing the country in your own way, then, you know, American country music is an established way to deal with it.
Yeah, I just think it sounds fantastic.
Yeah, I'm really excited.
We've been talking with, yeah, I hope you are. I think it's going to be an amazing book. I can't wait to read that one. We've just been talking for the last few minutes with Professor Tori Olson of the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. He's written an amazing book called Agrarian Crossings, Reformers and the Remaking of the U.S. and Mexican Countryside. It was published by Princeton this year, 2017. Professor Olson, we've had a tremendously good time talking with you.
Thank you so much for having me on. It was just a real pleasure to be here.
It was a great pleasure for me too. Thank you so much, and I wish you all the best.
Thanks.
Okay, bye-bye.